Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very great pleasure to introduce Robert Mundell as the 16th Lionel Robbins Memorial Lecturer, and it's especially thrilling to have him here so soon after he got the Nobel Prize for Economics. As you all know, he is the world's leading macroeconomist of the open economy, and in fact, I think one could say that he invented the modern subject of macroeconomics in the open economy, so that when an undergraduate is lying awake, unable to still his mind, he sees a 2x2 table of fiscal and monetary policy in the fixed and flexible exchange rates, and he's trying to fill in those boxes. That is the Mundell-Fleming model that he's grappling with. There's also, of course, the Mundell of the optimum currency area, who is being cited most weeks on both sides of the controversy about whether Britain should join the EMU, and I'm sure we shall hear a bit about what he actually thinks about that during the course of these lectures. So he's a person of huge range. He got his PhD at the MIT, and he has been teaching for a long time now at Columbia University. But it's a matter of great pride for us that he started his economic research at the LSE as a student of James Mead, at a time when Lionel Robbins was the moving force in the economic department. So it's really wonderful that he's coming back to us here now at such an interesting moment in European economic history. He's going to be giving three lectures today, tomorrow, and on Thursday at the same time. And he's going to talk for about 50 minutes, and then we'll have some questions. And the topic, the small topic that he's going to talk on, is the world economy since 1900. What have we learned? Bob Mundell.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's a great pleasure to be here and to give this very wonderful set of lectures in honor of Lord Lionel Robbins. I met Lionel, as I called him most times, or sometimes Lord Robbins, but he wasn't Lord when I met him in 1955 when I came to MIT, or to LSE from MIT. I finished my doctoral work at MIT and had fully planned to go on and write my dissertation there, but I got this suddenly Mackenzie King traveling scholarship, which let me go anywhere, and I decided I'd take the opportunity and come to Europe for the first time to study at LSE, and what better under James Mead in my field of trade, and in a department that had been made so illustrious by Lionel Robbins. And on my first day here, I went to see Robbins and the chairman. I had regards from Paul Samuelson and others from MIT, and we spent an hour discussing this huge office that he'd had that seemed to be larger than most classrooms. Oddly enough, on the subject that mainly concerned was about Dostoevsky. I don't know how we got onto it. I think we were talking about The Idiot, and we spent a long time talking about that. But then later I got to know Lionel again when I was teaching at the a couple of years in the Johns Hopkins Bologna Center, the School of Advanced International Studies. And Lionel came every year to that institution in Bologna, and he gave wonderful lectures. And I remember particularly in 1963, he coming and us having, 61 actually, a conversation about European currency, and he had come out very early in favor of a European currency at that time, 1961, quite astonishing. The next intersection, I'm going to stop this soon because I was in 35 years ago, in 1965, when the LSE invited me to give 3 lectures. I think they were thinking of hiring me, possibly. I was then at Chicago, and I came, gave 3 lectures, and Robbins introduced me in each occasion. And he took me to the Athenaeum Club, and he gave me his, he was chairman of the Financial Times then, and he let me use his Rolls Royce. We dropped him off one time. We went to the Athenaeum Club and then dropped him off at the House of Lords, and then I had the use of his wonderful car and chauffeur. And another one other evening with Iris at the Lady Robbins at the Covent Garden, where this was the week, oddly enough, that Nureyev had come to London, and we had this wonderful evening on Thursday. It was his 4th performance. I remember Iris, Lady Robbins, being a little critical. He said, "Oh, Nureyev is not jumping as high tonight." Apparently he'd hurt his leg. But we had these this wonderful dinner backstage, and it was just a wonderful treat for me at that point. Now, I'm going to, as it happens, in my second lecture, talk a little bit more about Lionel on some issues connected with the Bretton Woods arrangements in which he took a part. But what I want to do now is to get into my lecture, which, when Richard asked me what I'd like to speak on if I did give these lectures, and I said, well, I'm giving the title of my Nobel Prize lecture was a modest title, A Reconsideration of the 20th Century. They make you give the title of it before you have the content of it written, and that was the title, and I thought that when I treated that subject in 50 minutes, 45 minutes, which is the deadline for a Nobel Prize lecture in a huge hall of the Magna Aurea in Aula at the University of Stockholm, 1,500 people, there's a deadline of 45 minutes for the speech, and I thought that was a little short to cover the whole century. And I did it in rather brief form, but what I could do in these lectures is to spell out some of the details a little more. And in 3 lectures on the 20th century, I decided to divide the century up. As it happens, by magic, it divides up into 3 almost equal parts. And these are, this is the title of it. A little different from the title that Richard said, but it's close enough. Reinterpretation of the 20th century. What did we do wrong and what have we learned? That's the basic thing. And in case some of you are brave enough to come for another lecture or two, this is what will be broken down. Phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3. Of the lectures. So the first phase is on entry into the 20th century, the gold standard, and then what happened in that phase with the break with the war, and then the restoration of the gold standard again. And what I'm arguing in this is that it was the restoration of the gold standard that was in large part the culprit for the Great Depression. So all these early events are very closely connected together. I'll talk about the World War I inflation, then the restoration of the gold standard, followed by the depression that reversed that inflation. And then phase 2, the policy mix contradictions, because the consequences of the breakdown of the gold standard and the bad experience that people had with it in the 1930s, led to a whole revolution in economic policy. Part of it was Keynes's general theory, but it was also the developments that Keynes had already made in his 1923 tract on monetary reform. But the basic idea of monetary management as opposed to the automaticity of the gold standard. And that created a problem because after Bretton Woods, 1944, we went on to a fixed exchange rate system. But policies and academics were arguing for monetary management as if countries had a closed economy. Remember, Keynes' general theory was written for a closed economy. So that created the problems, and that's one of the contradictions that we'll talk about in the second lecture. And then phase three was the breakdown of that system, the open inflation that resulted, and then gradual formation of currency areas as an alternative to national currencies on flexible exchange rates, and a gradual groping back to principles that aren't so fundamentally different from the principles in which we started at the beginning. That's really what I'm saying, that we're going back to policies that are not so different from the policies that we left and were discredited in the gold standard. We're learning about them in a different way. So in this lecture then, I'm going to talk about the first third of the century, and we'll then connect up that with the other aspects of it later on. So here I've given another little variation on the title here this is the title, this is the outline of the third lecture of this lecture now. Fatal Folly, Gold and the Great Depression. Fatal Folly, what is the Fatal Folly? We'll say a few things about what the gold standard really was, how it differed from the textbooks, was it in trouble before World War I, and then the new significance of the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System was created in 1913. And then the Tempest, the Great War, the Thornton Effect, post-war recession, the instability of gold, and the false stability, the return to gold, the fatal return to gold, and the effect of that, the way that brought about the great deflation, stock market crash, and the Great Depression, and then what the lessons are, which I'll come to a little bit later. Well, I'll leave that on for a minute to talk about the what the gold standard really was. The gold standard was a way of having a common currency in the world. If you like, under the gold standard, currencies were different. Were names for different weights of gold. The pound happened to be pound sterling, which was made of gold, happened to be 4.87 times as much gold as the US dollar. So the exchange rate, the par exchange rate, was 4.87, and so on and so on. So that was one way of getting a common currency over the world that was on the gold standard. Now, in fact, in the 1880s and even as late as the 1900s, there were several countries, many in the less developed world, but also including China, that were on the silver standard. So it wasn't completely a world currency. There wasn't a complete monetary unity in the world. There was flexible exchange rates in that period between the gold currencies and the silver currencies. Now, if you have to go to get real monetary unity, you have to go before 1873, because from 1815 to 1873 was the period when of bimetallism, and either the United States or France kept the bimetallic ratio fixed, and so the gold and silver countries, it didn't matter whether you were on the gold standard like Britain or on the silver standard like Germany and a lot of other, Prussia and a lot of other countries, there was a monetary unity in the world. Then after the Civil War in the United States, the U.S. went off specie, so it wasn't taking part in keeping bimetallism together. And then after the Franco-Prussian War, France went off specie, so no big country was keeping the bimetallic system together. So a few smaller countries like the Netherlands and Switzerland for a while, but by 1873 that broke up, and then the gold and silver countries went their own way. Now, the gold standard then for the gold countries, and I could say the bimetallic system often, in a way, even more. Sir Roy Herod once said that bimetallic system was a highbrow system. In the words, when that phrase was used, bimetallic system was a highbrow system. A gold standard, a silver standard, a monometallic standard was a lowbrow system. I think that he's right in that, because it's certainly more sophisticated to have a common monetary unity and let some countries, poorer countries on silver and richer countries on gold. But people didn't really understand the bimetallic system very well, and so it became quite discredited later on. There were tremendous bimetallic controversies in the last third of the 19th century, and very heated debates over this issue, because it roused a lot of passion. People blamed the gold standard for causing the deflation of that last period. Anyway, the gold standard before the war, it gave for the gold standard countries a common currency, number one. Second, it gave them an automatic monetary policy. Monetary policy was predetermined. The balance of payments determined gold flows, and gold flows determined money supplies, and that automatically determined the monetary policy of individual countries. And it gave an outside decision in the world for what the price level was going to be. It was determined by the world's gold stock in relation to the demand for that gold. And of course it would be affected by gold production and gold demand, but over the long run, the price level had been remarkably constant. There's a book written by Roy Jastrom called The Golden Constant, published in 1977, in which he calculated the price level from 1560, the beginning of Elizabeth's reign, more or less, until 1979, when he was when his book, or 1977, when his book came out. And he showed that there were ups and downs, but the ups canceled out the downs, and on the long run, the price level, centuries apart, was about the same, an amazing stability. Not that that stability is all that important to us, because we're really not concerned necessarily whether the things are stable from one century to the next. We're more concerned about whether they're stable from one decade to the next. But that constancy was there. The fact is that the ups and downs created difficulties, but they were rather small compared to the ups and down. No downs, not many downs in this century, mainly ups. The instability of the 20th century. So you could criticize the gold standard and what it did, and or bimetallism, but it was much more stable in terms of the value of money than the 20th century monetary systems. Now, Keynes, in his book, The Tract on Monetary Reform in 1923, started to talk about that there was a change in the gold standard before the war, and it had become not working so much like the textbook experience, but a little bit more, and here he's absolutely right, it was increasingly being managed by central banks. It wasn't an issue of you have a dozen or a couple of dozen countries on the gold standard, you have many more than that on the gold standard, but you have a few big players in the field. And the fact that the size configuration started to affect the way the gold standard was working. And this became very important, and especially important when the Federal Reserve System was created, 1913. Can you imagine the biggest country in the world, the biggest economy in the world, without a central bank before 1913? And imagine the impact and importance of that central bank once it was created. 1913. We didn't have much peacetime experience to see what would happen over the period, but I'm quite sure that it would have had a fundamental impact on the way the gold standard worked in the future. And think of it, what was the size configuration of economies in 1914? Well, the United States was three times as large as the second biggest economy, which was Britain or Germany. Britain and Germany were about the same. Germany was rapidly coming up and had a very strong period of growth and was approaching the British level of, say, at that time. So the U.S. economy was very, very large relative to all the other economies. And proportionately, the U.S. had a lot of gold. So this was how it started to play a big role in the gold standard, as Russia did before World War One. Well, management by central banks would become 10 times more important after the war, because that the size configuration was increasing all the time. Because, and certainly when war broke out and at the end of the war, the European countries were devastated to a large extent. They had a lot of difficulties, and the competitors, rivals of the United States, if you like, had become small, and the U.S. had become more and more important. So the dominance of the United States in the even and the immediate post-war period was very, very high. And to a large extent, the story of the gold standard became a story of the dollar. They became almost indistinguishable. Because now let's go into the Tempest, the Great War. During the war, all the belligerent countries in Europe, the United States, of course, didn't get into the war until 1917 and didn't supply troops, really, until 1918. The European countries went to war, and they started with deficit finance. Well, what happens when a country starts off with deficit finance? What does our economics say about it? What do the great economists in the past say about it? David Hume. David Hume wrote about this. He wasn't the only one, but he wrote about it in a very important way. What happens if a country on a gold standard creates credit? It could be a bank credit, or it could be paper currency. As Adam Smith tried the experiment with paper currency. If a country creates paper currency, that automatically displaces gold. And Gresham's law works out. The paper currency stays home, and the gold leaves. The paper currency can't leave because the paper currency isn't acceptable abroad. That's what Gresham's law is all about. Of course, Gresham's law wasn't created by Gresham. It was created 100 years before Aristophanes wrote his wonderful play called The Frogs. And in The Frogs of Aristophanes, he talks about as if he's not claiming credit for Gresham's law. He talks about these owls, the owls of Athens, the drachmas of Athens. All the good owls have gone away, and all the poor owls stay in Athens. Of course, this is because Athens had overvalued their drachma in the late 5th century, and that was when Aristophanes was writing. So there are wonderful descriptions of Gresham's law in the Greek period. But anyway, it worked here. If anyone creates paper currency, that displaces gold, and the gold leaves. Now, so the curious thing is that as long as they keep the currency convertible, that doesn't have any effect upon the price level, because the money supply in that country doesn't change. You create, Hume would say, we have 30 billion pounds in Great Britain, and if we create 10 million pounds at that time, this is the 1750s he's writing in, 10 million pounds, it'll drive out 10 million of gold. And the money supply won't change, and so there's no change in prices. He thought, well, that's where Thornton came into effect. In 1802, Thornton wrote his wonderful book, and which Thornton criticized Hume and Smith for not taking account of the fact that the gold that leaves would increase the supply of gold in the rest of the world and therefore raise prices in the rest of the world. Now, if Hume was able to answer Thornton, he'd probably say that Henry is quibbling because it's not a very big effect. Hume was thinking of the small open economy, and now would have to be a big effect in order to have much impact and so on. For example, if a country is 10% of the world economy and it's got 10% of the gold and they displace half their currency, they increase credit to the extent of half their money supply, that will result in an increase in the price level. It's like 100% initial increase in money. That will increase the world price level by only 5%. So it will be a small effect if it's a small country. But now, I call this the Thornton effect because Thornton becomes very important when there are big countries are doing it. All of Europe is doing it, and gold flows to the United States. And what does the newly created Federal Reserve System do with it? If it had been thinking, it would have said, we have a real new problem. We should appreciate our currency or something, or we should sterilize these gold imports. But they weren't confident about what to do, and they were still in this think mindset in which they thought, if they stay on gold, they're not going to have inflation. So they bought the gold, money supply was created, and the price level in the United States doubled. That was so the price level in the United States doubled from 1914 to 1920. That, by the way, in that, as late as 1917, the Secretary of the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, his name was Leffingwell, a very smart man, said, he gave a talk to the American Economic Association saying, the U.S. has no inflation because they've stayed on gold. The prices have doubled. But then later he realized that he had made a mistake, and a couple of years later and he admitted to making a mistake. But anyway, in 1920, then now most of the other countries were off gold. The United States was basically the only country on gold. What that meant is that gold had become unstable. The value of gold had fallen in half. The value of a dollar had fallen in half, and dollars and gold were the same thing. When the price level doubles, gold depreciates in terms of gold. So gold had become, you could say, unstable. Now, it was made more unstable because the Federal Reserve, now realizing that they'd created inflation, they felt guilty about it, and they engineered a deflation. And the price level came crashing down until about 60% of the inflation had been corrected. But in 1921, this was the recession of 1920 and 21. In that recession, the price level of the United States was still 40% above its 1914 level. And it remained at that level throughout the most of the rest of the 20s until 1928. So now, why didn't they go all the way and bring the price level back to where it was? Well, because the deflation was causing a tremendous commotion, and the Federal Reserve then came out and said, we're going to now change our goals of monetary policy. We're going to shoot for a stable price level. Remember that Irving Fisher had advocated a stable price level in the 1912-1913 period. And Keynes came out in his book arguing the importance of price stability rather than exchange rate stability. And the Fed may have been influenced by Keynes's book as well as by Fisher. So that was the policy. Well, now, think of what that meant. Well, in the world that you had, it was a world that wasn't all that different from the world that later became, we think of as the Bretton Woods era. Because in the Bretton Woods era, just to anticipate something, and I'm sure you know this. U.S. was the only country to fix the price of gold and to buy and sell gold freely for foreign central banks. The rest of the world fixed their currency to the dollar. The U.S. fixed to gold. That was the situation from 1914 to 1924, because Britain, the pound was floating, and the French currency was going up and down in different ways, and the German currency was in hyperinflation, these other big currencies. And the dollar became thought of as the price level. The dollar was the way in which people started to reckon. The 1920s, 1915 even, is the date when the dollar began to be dominated as the world unit of account, overtaking the pound in importance, because before that, the pound had been at least as important as the dollar, and in some ways more important. Anyway, what are the implications if the price level is 40% above what it was earlier? Well, not too much, as long as you have a system in which the United States fixes to gold and the other countries fix to the dollar, or something like that. But what would happen if the other countries, as they were hankering to do, wanted to go back to gold? Well, there'd be a big increase in demand for gold. And then that price level would have a big problem, because when the price level is 40% above the pre-war level, it meant that the real value of gold reserves of the same quantity would have been 40% less. Gold would be underpriced by that extent. So it would be an issue of how that would affect the demand for gold. Well, that's what did happen. The Germany stabilized and was the first to go back to gold when it stabilized from its hyperinflation. It got the Dawes loan, it got France and Belgium out of the Ruhr and as a part of the bargain for resuming payment on reparations, and they fixed the mark with a trillion to one conversion. A trillion of the old marks was exchanged for one new gold mark. Now, this was a good way of stopping the inflation, but think of what it did, because the German price level had gone up 1.4 trillion times. But their currency conversion was only 1 trillion times. So the German currency, compared to the 1914 level, was 40% overvalued relative to gold. But because the American dollar was also 40% overvalued with respect to gold, then the gold mark was at the right ratio with respect to dollars. Well, then Britain sped up because Germany had gone on and didn't want Germany to get ahead of her, and a lot of other reasons, went back to gold in 1925. And then France in 1926 de facto, and then 1928 de jure, and then the rest of the world followed. Nearly maybe 80-100 countries followed in the 1920s. Well, think of what that does to the demand for gold in the world. It just means that you get a sudden increase in the price level, the dollar price level, and the real value of gold was okay as long as most of the gold was in the United States and the rest of the world didn't need it for their own currencies. But when they all went back to gold, this increased greatly the demand for gold, creating an excess demand for gold and the potential for monetary inflation. Now, this is I'm going to put on a diagram here. Just a model. You could make this. This is a stripped down general equilibrium model, but you could make it with all the different many countries in the world, and you have exchange markets and everything else like this. But this line on this axis is the price level, the dollar price level in the U.S., and this is the price of gold in the United States. And if you if you doubled the price of gold, this would say that this would ultimately give you a doubling of the price level, because that would, it's like a increasing the price of gold is like a devaluation. This is the equilibrium. The M curve is the total money supply. It gives you the that determines the equilibrium price level. The G curve is the gold backing for that. If there's only if gold were the only money, the price level would be down here. But with the banking system, then the price level is up at that level. So that's the sort of equilibrium that we're going to now disturb with the mechanism that I talked about, the Thornton effect, when countries expand their money supplies without any change in the amount of gold in the system. So what you get is a movement that puts the money supply goes out here, the price of gold stays constant, and you move out to that position. And in that position, the ratio of gold value to the money supply falls. That's because all the countries of Europe are producing money, but they don't have much gold. All the gold has gone to the United States, and but the total amount of liquidity that's been created has increased. Now, that kind of situation could be maintained as long as there is no increase in demand for gold. Well, anyway, there's another little step in it. The next step is that's the inflation and the halving of the value of gold. The next step is the deflation of the 2021, which brings us back to 40% above the original price level, which is where the P91, the price level in 91, and that was the price level that stayed there in the 1920s. Well, then the coup de grace, so to speak, was when the countries all went on to the gold standard. In Britain, it was, of course, Winston Churchill was Chancellor of the Exchequer. Montague Norman, the so-called mystery man of high finance, was the patient of Jung in Zurich, was the governor of the Bank of England. And there's an interesting story of how he wanted to increase the PR of the Bank of England, and he tried to, he asked T.E. Lawrence to come and see him. He came to see him, and then he asked him to work for him. But T.E. Decided he preferred being an Air Force mechanic and went back to doing that. The return to gold and deflation, that brought us back to the equilibrium from which we started. Price level, more or less back at where it was in 1914. Well, this is the figure here. Price level in 1930 is 100, and the 1914 price level is 78.4, and then it went up to 1928 was the 1978 was the post-war 1920 the post-war high, and the wartime and post-war high, more than a doubling of the price level, and then it fell back in 1 year to 113. Compared to, you can see that's about 40% above what it was, and it stayed that way, 1928, and then 1930, it got down to 100, and then 84, and then 76. Now, so it gets back magically to where it started. Well, this is what the gold standard was supposed to do. It was, you buy your system, and the system says, the gold standard says, I give you price stability. So you had the price level there, and gold requirements for the world being on the gold standard gave you a price level there. And then in the 1920s, countries went back to gold, and the price level, the gold standard, did its job. It brought the price level back down to where it was before. This is just what anyone would think or should think. did anybody think that? Did anybody at the time think that? Well, the answer is yes. Yes, the three economists were very vocal about it. One was Charles Riest, later governor of the Bank of France. And Riest was instrumental, along with Jacques Reff, a very young Jacques Reff, who was instrumental in setting the parity for the franc. The franc had about an 80% devaluation. They made the French franc, the pre-war franc had been 19.3 cents, and they made the new franc in the post-war period. The new parity for the franc was 3.9 something. So you can see what big devaluation that was. But it was a very big devaluation that undervalued the franc relative to the pound and even the dollar and the mark, but it didn't undervalue the franc relative to gold, because Riest had a view, a theory, that it was the relation to gold that was important in terms of the liquidity of the position. So certainly the franc was undervalued relative to the other currencies, but not relative to gold. And if you carry out the history of that, France was the last country to have to leave the gold standard. France was still on the gold standard until 1936, when they had their devaluation. So those three economists, Riest was one. The second was Ludwig von Mises, who had written his book in 1912, The Theory of Money and Credit, a very good book. And then in the second edition of that book, he, in 1924, he talks about going back to the gold standard would create a very big deflation and a painful deflation. But nevertheless, he recommended going back to the gold standard because he thought that the officials and the people deserved the deflation because they had created the mistake of the inflation in the first place. So it was this root canal economics very much involved in this, which was not so helpful. Much better was Gustav Cassell, who before Britain went back to gold warned that going back to gold would create an appreciation of gold. It would involve an appreciation of gold and therefore deflation. An appreciation of gold is the same as saying deflation. And this would be a big one and a terrible one. It would be one that would cause all kinds of damage and distress in the world. And then he said that, then after Britain did go back to gold in 1928, he said, unless we find an alternative to gold, unless we can somehow economize on gold, then we'll have a deflation that will curl our hair. He didn't use that term, but something like that. It would be a really big deflation. And then in 1928 also, Cassell, by the way, had been very critical of the French, because the French had enacted a monetary law that was a pure gold standard type law. It said that no francs can be created that are not backed by gold. And what that meant was that to create francs, then you had to have French had to have gold. Now the French had some pounds. They sold that to the Bank of England. They cashed that in for gold, and that put pressure on the pound. There was a big, long, interesting discussions between Governor Moreau in the Bank of France and Montague Norman in the Bank of England. Montague Norman had been saying, "You're doing this, but you're causing great difficulties for the pound. We ask you not to do that." But nevertheless, the collapse of the gold exchange standard became well documented. We know that that did occur. Keynes picked up on this issue. Keynes, when he saw the monetary law of the Bank of France, said that this monetary law would create a big problem, deflationary tendencies in the community. And he now started to warn of deflation, just as those three other continental economists had warned of it. Gustav Cassell, of course, was Swedish from this, and one of the great authorities on international economics at that time. So there was this general view of it. Now, what could have prevented the deflation? Well, if you went back to those diagrams, you say that it was the problem of the ratio of gold to money. But it was not the physical quantity of gold to money, but the price of gold times the amount of gold to money. If you'd raised the price of gold, the deflation wouldn't have been necessary. You'd have created a new price level, equilibrium. And if few people had said, let's raise the price of gold to $35 an ounce, let's say, which is what President Roosevelt did raise it to in 1934. But after the deflation had taken place, there'd have been no deflation. Maybe there'd have been no depression, and maybe no Second World War. Because who could believe that the Second World War would have been created, even that Hitler would have come to power in the absence of a depression? Loss of decline in wholesale prices, not just the United States, I'm emphasizing the United States, but the deflation was generalized throughout the world. The lowest country here is China, but China was on the silver standard, and China was on a much better, a little bit better, it fared better because the price of silver had fallen relative to the price of gold, and the Mexico and China, both on the silver standard, didn't get dragged into the same depression to the same extent. Now later, this is part of, should be part maybe of tomorrow's lecture, but I'm not going to talk about it tomorrow, so I may mention here that the U.S. floated in 1933. It went off gold. Britain went off gold in 1931. The United States went off in 1933. And then President Roosevelt started to play around with the silver price. He started to buy up silver just for breakfast. And I mean, at breakfast every morning with his advisors, he'd talk, they'd joke about, what should we make the price of silver today? And they'd invent some reason why, some magic number. Roosevelt had a big sense of humor. And they would start buying up silver. Congress had, there are always silver advocates in the United States, and Congress had advocated, had recommended and enacted legislation to add silver to the stock. What that did was, for the first time, it appreciated silver. It raised the world price of silver very substantially, and for the first time, put China into a depression. And that's what brought Mao Zedong to power. That was the basic story of what that disastrous effect of that increase in the price of silver in the United States that created a depression in China and tremendous embarrassment for the Chiang Kai-shek government. So, but anyway, in terms of the gold story, I put this on just to show that this was a worldwide phenomenon, and that an attempt to show that in some sense, the gold standard, or the United States created the depression, really misses something important. Of course, the United States was closely involved with the depression because of the Federal Reserve policy and so on, but it was, you could just as well say it was Europe that went back to gold that created the new demands for gold without paying attention to the need for making making an increased liquidity. There's many, many details in this. So many books have been written about this subject. You know that the story of the 1931, failure of the Credit Anstalt in Austria, and the run on the German banks and the exchange controls in Germany. There was a move to the Von Papen government was thinking of raising, devaluing, but and devaluation for Germany would have been, if they, that would have been a good idea. If Germany had just had a big, quick devaluation, that would have forced Britain into a devaluation, and soon the United States, and then all countries would have devalued, which would have raised the price of gold, and you'd have got back to a kind of new equilibrium. But the German labor unions came up to von Papen and said to him, if you raise the price of gold, you devalue, or raise the price of the dollar, foreign exchange, we will increase wages in proportion to it, because of course there is no money illusion in Germany anymore, having suffered the great hyperinflation of the 1920s. So devaluation was ruled out, and Germany instead went to controls. And that was one of the reasons why Germany had a lower rate of deflation than some of the other countries. See. Now, so we come to the end. What are the lessons of this? And here I've listed them in this form. The myth and reality. The myth is because if you look over the what people write about this story, it's really quite different from the story that I've told you. There's been tons of books written on the causes of the Great Depression. A little bit like the causes of World War I, nobody's really found a completely satisfactory answer to it. And in part because there's been a big debate between the Keynesians and monetarists as to whether what caused the depression was a collapse of the investment schedule or whether it was a collapse of the money supply. Of course, both of these things went on, but it doesn't do any good to say, to prove that, or just restrict yourself to asking, was it a collapse of the investment schedule or the money supply? When both of them went down, you still have to find the things that would have allowed you to predict that this would have happened. Now, how much was there in history to allow us to predict that going back onto the gold standard would cause deflation? Well, there were three episodes in history, if people chose to look at them, that they should have known that. And Kessel would have known that. Kessel was the best historian of those. Maybe Charles Riest would also have known that. I mentioned the movement to bimetallism, the movement away from bimetallism and then on to gold. When bimetallism broke down, the price of silver started to fall relative to gold, and then people saw this new silver supplies coming from the United States, from Nevada, big new silver mines were opening up, and then also Germany with taking her reparations from France of 5 billion francs went on to the gold standard and dumped a lot of silver on the world market. And so then the Scandinavian countries did that too. So the countries were chucking silver and buying gold. Well, the purchase of gold created a deflation. From 1873, that deflation lasted from 1873 until 1896. Long years of two decades or more of deflation. And that's what gave rise to that tremendous controversy in the United States over bimetallism, also in many other countries, but principally in the United States over bimetallism, because the tempers that were raised in favor of bimetallism, it wasn't really that people were so much attached to silver, is that they hated deflation. And they felt that the government had imposed this deflation on them. There's this crime of 73 they talked about, the fact that in 1873 General Grant signed a bill that that didn't allow when they went back to parity, went back to gold in 1879, it didn't allow for the creation of a silver dollar, and that was called the crime of 73. And then William Jennings Bryan in 1896, the presidential campaign, had his famous Cross of Gold speech, as it was called, in which he said the American farmer had been crucified on a cross of gold. He was a big on, played a big role in that future evolution trial. On the, he supported the Bible against the evolutionists in that famous Scopes trial later on. But that was the passions. It was an attack on deflation over that period. And the deflation was predictable, because whenever countries go on to a gold standard, that creates deflation. Whenever countries chuck the silver standard, as Germany and other countries were doing, that created inflation. Eventually, the silver countries became inflationary, and the other countries became deflationary. Go back 50 years earlier. Go back to 1821. Britain went on to the gold standard, and so did other countries after the Napoleonic Wars. Created deflation. The deflation of the 1820s was due to that movement on to the gold standard. Go back to the 1780s. What happened then? Well, even earlier in the middle 18th century, the British put India onto a silver standard. And this increased the demand for specie in the world. And India was a big country, the huge demand for specie. It became the sump for the precious metals, as people said, imposing deflation. So there was a lot of evidence that really, really backed that up. Well, anyway, to tidy up this, the lessons, the thinking on this is that inflation was caused by deficit spending. This is a minor thing. It was caused by the Thornton effect, as I've explained it here. I mean by that, I'm talking about U.S. inflation. Of course, inflation in the rest of the world with depreciation was caused by deficit finance and money expansion associated with that. Number two here, World War I inflation had nothing to do with the deflation of the 1930s. Well, read all the literature on this by eminent economists, including expert historians like Peter Temin and so on. They always start with 1925 or 1929. They're ahistorical in connection with this. They're also closed economy. In the models in which these have been debated, there's a wonderful book edited by Carl Brunner, in which all the models that are used to test it are closed economy models. The ISLM model, instead of the, if you pardon me, the Mundell-Fleming model, which would be at least a little better. So the deflation of the 30s was the mirror image of the inflation there. Then number three, the deflation and depression without precedence. I've just mentioned that. And then the depression was a crisis of capitalism, as Marx predicted. No, it was a crisis of the gold standard, and definitely man-made. And then adjustment under the gold standard requires instability of relative price levels. That's not true. It's not true, and it's important. Maybe I didn't emphasize it earlier on, but when Keynes wrote his book, his excellent book, really, Milton Friedman always said this was his best book, tract on monetary reform. But he talked about the relation between either internal stability or external stability. And you can have fixed exchange rates, external stability, but then you have to have an internal price level moving. Or you can have internal price level moving, but then you have to have the exchange rate moving. This book is completely dominated by that episode of the inflation during the war and the big deflation in 1921. He wrote it in 1922. And this was very fresh in his mind. He was absolutely right for that one episode. But he's completely wrong. It's completely wrong to take that episode as an indication of what is likely in reality or what happens when you've got a unified monetary system. If you look over the centuries of the gold standard or the bimetallism, you don't find that deficit countries have deflation and surplus countries have inflation. They all have the same price level. You find all through the 19th century that the major countries on gold or silver standards had booms and recessions at the same time. There was a global recession, and the prices went up and down, but they went up for all countries and down for all countries. In the same way that if you have, Scotland gets into a deficit relative to England, the price level in Scotland doesn't go down, and the price level in England doesn't go up. All it involves in deficits is a shift of expenditure from one group of countries to another. That's a lesson that'll come up again in the number two in the second lecture. And the final point there is that automaticity was a failure because economists did turn against the idea of the gold standard. They blamed the gold standard for the depression. It moved very quickly to espouse the idea of macroeconomic management, particularly in the United States, and in a way, it was a closed economy, macroeconomic management, but the United States could get away with it. Think of Keynes, 1936, writing his book, 1936. The last part of the night, the U.S. had just devalued the dollar, gold had been raised to $35 an ounce. Gold was temporarily overpriced. There was even a gold scare in 1937 when people thought that the price of gold might be lowered again. And so gold was coming to the United States in huge amounts, and by 1945, the United States had 70% of the world's stock of gold. So over this whole period, American economists particularly developed a theory of macroeconomic management that was based on a closed economy. They simply could ignore the balance of payments because the United States had such vast excess gold reserves. The dollar was the king, the big currency, and you could ignore it, and it didn't become a problem until later on in the 1950s and the early 1960s. That we'll pick up the threads for our lectures tomorrow. But so it's way the harm done from the episode wasn't just that the going back to the gold standard created the Depression and the Second World War. It was also that it warped economists' mind away from thinking about an international monetary system into thinking about national monetary management at a time when they did have an international monetary system. And what we're going to and as I said later on, only later, finally at the end of the depressing century, do we get into a case where we go back to the roots that we had with the a kind of gold standard type mechanism with different rules about what determines the price level. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Bob. Amazing sweep. We're going to have a short period of questions when you can ask Bob any question you want about what he said or what he hasn't said. Who would like to start? Well, I would like to ask you one question. When these countries went back onto the gold standard, were they trying to reduce the price level? And if they were trying to reduce the price level, why were they trying to reduce the price level?
Well, the answer is they weren't trying to reduce the price level. None of them wanted the price level in the 1920s to go down. They wanted, nobody wanted deflation that's period. Mm. Britain was perhaps the single country, because Britain went back to the old parity, and the British price level hadn't quite adjusted even to the American price level. If the dollar was 40% overvalued relative to gold for a gold standard, the British currency was overvalued by 50%. So most people, Keynes was very critical of the return to the gold standard, but not on the grounds, not in this systemic problem that I'm talking about. He was critical of Britain going back onto it because the pound-dollar rate wasn't the correct one, and that he thought that it should have been at least a 10%, it would have been better to go back at a rate of 10% depreciation rather than the existing one. But nobody wanted deflation.
You're saying therefore they didn't understand that that would be the consequence.
They didn't understand. And they weren't thinking in terms of currency theory had just cropped up. Remember, in 1912, Alfred Marshall said, he wrote in a letter to, I think it was Arthur Flux, one of his former students. He wrote that I'm never tired of preaching in the wilderness that the only important thing that can be said, needs to be said about currency, is that it is unimportant. Can you imagine in 1912, with a history of stability of England over this since 1821 of the pound over that period, you can sympathize with him for thinking about that, but just 3 years later it became so incorrect. But there was not much thinking about currency theory in that early period. But there was one book, there was a gold commission in the United States, 1925, published. It was in 1924, it was the commissioner, it was a one-man commission. It was John Park Young, an assistant professor at Princeton, who was a very bright man and collected a lot of very important work on of writings, of what, including some of Cassell's writings and some of Keynes' writings. And I think he told me once he had an invitation to see Signor Mussolini, and he always regretted not having gone to see him. But he recognized that there was a shortage of gold, and that putting and many economists recognized it, but nevertheless they went back to it again. Now maybe some of them thought, well, the escape from all this is going to be the gold exchange standard, because you can multiply gold by using pounds and sterling, and maybe that would be all right. But of course that became a very unstable component in the system, and at the first sign of trouble, countries cashed in their gold and dollars, their pounds and dollars, and that brought pressure onto the system.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to generalize something you pointed out. You pointed out that in the case of the U.S., the gold standard did not adjust balance of payments imbalances in the way it was supposed to under the UNCC Flowdown. I think it very seldom did this because the relationship between gold and domestic currency, between gold movements and domestic currency, didn't operate in the way that you said it should. And, I just welcome your comments on, whether one could have made this mechanism operate, because I think it was supposed to operate not just through the loss of gold coming back expenditure and bringing back balance in the balance of payments and vice versa. Surely there was supposed to be some price effect as well. There was supposed to be some downward deviation of prices in countries that have to deflate, some upward deviation, at least for a short time, in the country which is developing a surplus. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that I agree with you that no price movements were implied by the CBN's framework.
Well, you might have some changes in real exchange rates, a little bit that would be small, but they're really a small part. Remember that Keynes, over this period, didn't understand the theory of adjustment. He had this view with the same as Taussig and Viner initially had. They didn't, and paradoxically, they ignored expenditure effects. Whenever a country got into difficulties with an increase in the money supply, according to them, would have its effect on the balance of payments by raising prices, but ignoring the facts that an increase in the money supply directly increases the demand for imports, expenditure in the demand for imports. Part of that falls on domestic goods, and there's probably some little effect. But for Keynes didn't have that in his theoretical toolkit. That came out very clearly in his debate with Olin in the 1929 issue of the Economic Journal, the transfer problem. Keynes' view on that was just wrong. And then it took him a long time to grapple with it. And then in 1934, he wrote a letter to Olin saying that something about recognizing, restating what Olin had said. And then Keynes says, "I do not think I disagree with you." He was coming very, and he throughout had this view in his, and he kept this until for the end of his life, that the trade balance was somehow out there. It was a given thing. It wasn't something that was would increase or decrease with change with economic policy. It was out there. It was given by foreign demand and other things. So I think that was now one aspect that you. One issue here is about how the gold standard worked. Countries receive gold, and that's supposed to expand the money supply. Does it expand enough, or did countries sterilize the money expansions? If you look at the United States, you find that in the last part of the 1920s, credit increased, gold increased, but credit increased a lot. But if you take the whole period from 1914 until 1928, you find that gold increased by I'll just put a figure here, something like 25 or 30%, but credit increased by much less than that. So over the whole period, the United States was not. Allowing for the full amount. Now, but think of it, if the United States had done it, if the United States had followed this completely, given the instability of the war and the fact that there's a big demand, fallen demand for gold, they let prices rise. But if they'd kept prices up at that high level like that, and then countries had devalued and then thought they should go back to gold, of course, then you'd have had four times the deflation that you in fact had over that period.
More questions? Well, I didn't mention to you that Bob has two professions. He's also a professional painter. And we've had the most wonderful canvas, huge canvas tonight, and we've got two more canvases to come. I must tell you that tomorrow we shall be in the Peacock Theatre in the back of this building on the other side of the road, same time at 6 o'clock, and then the day after tomorrow we'll be back here at 6 o'clock. So we look forward very much to seeing you all then, and thank you again, Bob, for a wonderful start.